Hello, this is Ed Tremblay from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the Tar Heel Junior Historian magazine, produced by the North Carolina Museum of History. First article we're going to read is from the spring 2011 issue, which is called Remembering the Civil War. The first article is called The War Within the War in the Mountain Region. It was written by Michael C. Hardy, who has written numerous books and magazine articles about North Carolina's role in the Civil War. In October 2010, he was honored as North Carolina Historian of the Year by the North Carolina Society of Historians. Hardy lives in Western North Carolina. For the few citizens of Burnsville in Western North Carolina's Yancey County, April 10, 1864 dawned as an unseasonably cold day. More startling than the north wind freezing the residents, though, was the appearance of 40 women in the town streets. These mountain women headed for a storehouse where state authorities were keeping a supply of grain, probably meant to help the wives and widows of Confederate soldiers. The 40 women took all the grain they could carry. The next day, approximately 75 men under the command of Confederate Army deserter Montreville Ray arrived in Burnsville. They wounded the local Confederate enrolling officer, nearly killed a local store owner, and stole about 150 state-owned rifles. A few days later, Confederate soldiers arrived from Asheville. After some cannon shots, they charged the town, running off Ray and his men. The general store of Amos Ray, the father of Montreville Ray, was burned. According to local legend, the McElroy House served as a hospital for the wounded from both sides in the skirmish. No official Civil War battles took place in western North Carolina, but the mountain region saw its share of disagreement and conflict. Had you been a young person living in Virginia or around Atlanta, Georgia during the war, you would have known who the enemy was. They were wearing uniforms unlike the ones worn by your father and older brothers. In western North Carolina, seldom did the enemy wear uniforms. Instead, he was dressed like the people who lived next door. In fact, the enemy might have been the person next door. Montreville Ray had been born in Yancey County. Most western North Carolinians had opposed secession, but once the state left the Union in May 1861, men quickly volunteered for the Confederate Army. An estimated 27,000 from the mountain counties served. Some Confederate recruits were old. John Pate of Cherokee County was 75 when he joined the 29th North Carolina Troops. Others were quite young. Haywood County's John C. Brown was 16 when he joined the 16th North Carolina Troops. These men and boys left their families and communities, marching away to fight in places like Chancellorsville, Virginia, and Atlanta. Over 5,000 Western Tar Heels died in action on the battlefield or of disease. North Carolina's Confederate soldiers gained distinction in many of the war's most famous engagements, including Bethel, Gettysburg, and Chickamauga. Support for Confederate soldiers was widespread throughout western North Carolina. Women in various communities organized themselves into aid societies, such as one in Caldwell County called the Ladies of Lenore. These women raised money for the troops. They made and collected clothing, haversacks, blankets, medical supplies, and food. There were other collective efforts. Cornelia C. Henry recorded in her diary in November 1863 that there was a ladies' hospital in Asheville, and Bethel Baptist Church in McDowell County took up donations to buy religious reading material for the 58th North Carolina Troops. Many citizens made individual contributions, sending soldiers packages of food and clothes. A small number of people in the mountain region continued to support the Union even after North Carolina left it. Many of these families were happy to keep quietly to themselves. until the Confederate government instituted a draft in the spring of 1862. This law required white males ages 18 to 35 to serve in the Confederate Army. Some men with Unionist feelings slipped across the mountains to the west and enlisted in federal regiments instead. Jackson Gwin of Haywood County joined the 20th Kentucky Infantry in September 1864. A few men from Jackson, Macon, Clay, Cherokee, and Buncombe counties joined the 6th Indiana Cavalry in the summer of 1863. Some Western North Carolina men who joined the Union Army or Navy were prisoners of war, Confederate soldiers captured in a battle. Many of these men joined one of the United States volunteer regiments sent out west. Watauga County's Hezekiah Thomas, for example, was serving in the 58th North Carolina Troops when he was captured just south of Atlanta, Georgia, in September 1864. Thomas was sent to the Camp Douglas, Illinois prison camp. In May 1865, he volunteered for the United States Army because he was about to starve to death. Thomas was sent to Nebraska to make hay for the federal government so he would not have to fight against his former comrades. In autumn 1863, Western North Carolina men began to join local federal regiments, the 2nd North Carolina Mounted Infantry, the 3rd North Carolina Mounted Infantry, and the 13th Tennessee Cavalry. These regiments operated in the mountains of North Carolina and Tennessee, clashing with battalions of Home Guard. In July 1863, Governor Zebulon Vance, a Buncombe County native, created the Home Guard. Men who were generally too old or young for regular service, as well as discharged soldiers, made up this group. The group was assigned to round up deserters and draft dodgers hiding out in the mountains and to protect civilians. Many residents considered the local federal regiments, especially the 3rd North Carolina, to be scoundrels and thieves because they often plundered, robbed, and tormented mountain families. Jonathan and Melinda Horton of Watauga County estimated that their home was robbed 18 times in 14 days during April of 1865, mostly by men claiming to be Union soldiers. Some Western North Carolina men only joined the federal forces in the final months of the war after Confederate defeat was certain. In all, about 2,000 Western North Carolina men served in the Union Army. Another group of people, often called dissidents, lived in the mountain region. They cared for neither government, and they largely wished to be left alone. These people took to mountain caves and hollows once the draft law passed, doing their best to hide out until the war ended. There also were men hiding out who had joined or had been drafted into the Confederate Army and later deserted. These deserters often formed groups. One deserter camp in northern Mitchell County was rumored to have numbered 250 men. Another in Wilkes County reportedly had hundreds more. These men, usually well-armed, caused enormous problems. The only way they could eat and stay clothed was to steal. The groups frequently skirmished with the Home Guard. At times, regular Confederate soldiers arrived to break up deserter bands. Both the state and Confederate governments tried to provide some assistance, like food and salt, for the families of men in Confederate service. Families of deserters did not qualify for such aid. Their desperation led to raids, sometimes led by starving women like those in Burnsville. Along with deserters and conscription dodgers, the area included some federal soldiers who had escaped from prison camps farther east. These men were trying to return to federal lines in Kentucky and Tennessee. Often they traveled a type of underground railroad, meeting guides who conducted them from one safe house to another. The Banner Home in Banner Elk, present-day Avery County, and the Old English Inn in Spruce Pine in Mitchell County were two of these places. The guides were mostly local men and women, such as Keith and Melinda Blaylock. This Union-leaning pair had enlisted in the Confederate Army, she disguised as a boy named Sam, but neither got the chance to desert as planned. He gave himself a rash, and she revealed her identity in order to be discharged. The Blaylocks spent the rest of the war in western North Carolina aiding the Union cause. The Home Guard often clashed with people helping escaped Union prisoners. At one such skirmish in the Globe section of Caldwell County In January of 1865, Keith Blaylock lost an eye. Even the small minority populations in western North Carolina found themselves drawn into the conflict. Many American Indians in the Smoky Mountains joined Thomas's Legion of Cherokee Indians and Highlanders, which served as part of the Confederate Army under Colonel William H. Thomas. A few Cherokee served in the Union Army. Some enslaved African Americans, such as Mitchell County's Turner Chambers, escaped during the war years. Turner joined the 40th Regiment United States Colored Troops in April 1865. A few free persons of color served in the Confederate Army. Brothers Franklin and William Henry Cousins of Watauga County joined the 37th North Carolina Troops in November 1861. Franklin was killed in the Battle of Second Manassas in August 1862, leaving behind a wife and infant daughter. William survived the war and moved to Yancey County. While the Civil War formally ended in the spring of 1865, conflict continued in the mountain region for some time. Bands of men kept roaming the countryside, and it took years to quell the violence. Many former soldiers simply moved away, looking to start life anew in a different county or state. For generations, people passed down stories of destruction and hardship. Some stories told of truly tragic events like the Shelton Laurel Massacre, in which 13 suspected Unionists were executed by firing squad without a trial in Madison County. They had been captured by Confederates in response to a federal raid in Marshall that led to the deaths of a Confederate officer's children. Other accounts have been simple stories of hiding supplies in the woods from Union soldiers or bushwhackers. While no great armies fought in western North Carolina, the war and its hardships it caused were as real for residents there as they were for people living near Bentonville or Wilmington. Here are the captions for the accompanying photographs. By 1901, there were 70 United Confederate Veterans camps established in North Carolina. The Asheville camp claimed to be the largest. Confederate Colonel John B. Palmer commanded both the 58th North Carolina Troops and the Department of Western North Carolina. He lived in present-day Avery County. The McElroy House in Burnsville served as headquarters for the 1st Brigade of North Carolina Home Guard, as well as a makeshift hospital after a skirmish in the town in April 1864. Keith Blaylock and his wife Melinda each served briefly in the 26th North Carolina Troops. The Unionist pair also served as guides on an underground railroad moving soldiers who had escaped from prisons through Watauga County. The next article is called Running the Blockade. It was written by Laurie Sanderlin Dupstat, who is the program registrar for the North Carolina Maritime Museums in Beaufort. She holds a Bachelor of Arts in History from the University of North Carolina at Wilmington, and in 2011, when this was published, had 10 years of experience working in museums and historic sites. It was late on the evening of September 30th, 1864, when a fast ship named the Condor approached Fort Fisher, a Confederate stronghold just south of Wilmington. This vessel carried precious cargo for the Confederate Civil War effort. It also carried a very prominent person who stood looking longingly at the earthen fortifications. The passenger, Rose O'Neill Greenhow, was carrying important information as well as money from England. She knew if the Union Navy caught her, she'd likely be hanged for acts against the United States government. Rather than face capture after the Condor ran aground, Greenhow boarded a dinghy so soldiers could row her toward the fort. The Confederate spy and her small crew proved no match for the storm and the waves. Their boat capsized, and she drowned before making it to safety. Blockade runners like the Condor played a big part in North Carolina's Civil War story. What is one of the first lessons that a military force learns about defeating an enemy? Cut off their supplies. United States government leaders knew that the Confederacy needed food, clothing, and weapons to fight the Civil War. They hoped that blocking trade from the northern states and Europe would bring a faster end to the conflict. In April 1861, President Abraham Lincoln proclaimed a blockade of all southern ports. The North Atlantic Blockading Squadron was a fleet of Union ships with orders to stop ships trying to enter Virginia and North Carolina. Three additional squadrons were stationed along the southern coastline, South Atlantic, East Gulf, and West Gulf. At the start of the war, the blockading ships were few in number. It was almost impossible for the Union Navy to stop vessels from going in and out of Confederate-held ports. After Beaufort fell to Union forces in 1862, it became the headquarters for the North Atlantic Blockading Squadron. Rather than going to occupied ports in Virginia to get more coal for fuel or to repair a ship, the blockaders now had access to these services in North Carolina. As the war carried on, the number of vessels in the blockade grew. The Union shut down many other ports, making goods difficult to come by in the South. Southern states had to develop a way to receive supplies for the military and for the survival of the civilian population. Quick-minded businessmen began building new vessels in Europe. In the Confederacy, they refit ships that were sleek, fast, and quiet. These steam-powered ships came to be called blockade runners. Usually painted gray to match the water, the vessels would make their run at night, loaded down with supplies, such as shoes, cloth, guns, and ammunition, and even less critical goods like women's mirrors and bonnets. In return, the South sent cotton and other unfinished goods to Europe for trade. The Bahamas and Bermuda, islands located off the East Coast, offered perfect places to dump cargo destined for England and to take on goods returning to the South. Unfortunately, finished goods were not the only things loaded onto blockade runners from the temperate islands. Yellow fever, carried by infected mosquitoes, also came aboard ships. A blockade runner might have carried this horrible disease, also known as Yellow Jack, into Wilmington, the largest town in Civil War-era North Carolina. By winter of 1862, the fever had infected a third of the 5,000 people in Wilmington, killing many of these men, women, and children. So many died, town officials created a mass burial area in Oakdale Cemetery. For over 10 weeks, it raged with terrible violence. Medicines and provisions were both scarce and high in price. Those of the frightened inhabitants that were able to do so fled the town, James Sprunt wrote in Chronicles of the Cape Fear. All business was abandoned, and the closed stores and silent streets gave the appearance of a deserted city. Fort Anderson became the quarantine station for ships after the epidemic of 1862. Major General William Henry Chase Whiting, Confederate commander of the Cape Fear District, issued orders that all blockade runners had to stop there and earn a clean bill of health before steaming up the Cape Fear River to Wilmington. Blockade running, while dangerous, could prove profitable. Confederate government was heavily involved. It tried to regulate what was traded through the blockade and what price goods would be sold. The Confederate and state governments had their own steamers that ran the blockade. A certain percentage of cotton had to be shipped out on each ship of a private blockade runner. Often, ship owners gave gifts to government officials in return for leniency when it came to the rules. Everything was sold through the blockade, from rifles and cannons to blankets and flag bunting. Homefront goods such as cotton combing cards, a sort of brush used to prepare cotton fibers for spinning to make homemade cloth, sewing needles, irons, and cloth for dresses would fetch a hefty price from civilians who could afford them. As more southern ports closed, Wilmington became the premier blockade running site. Ship captains could choose from two inlets, New and Old, both heavily guarded by Confederate fortifications. At New Inlet, Union naval officers of the blockading squadron knew they had to give up the chase once they were in range of Fort Fisher's guns. Heavy seacoast cannons guarded the inlet and protected blockade runners. Military cargo was unloaded from ships and sent on to the Wilmington and Weldon Railroad to Virginia to supply the Confederate Army. With the capture of Fort Fisher in January 1865, the result of the largest bombardment and land-sea operation in history to that point, the Confederacy's last port closed to the blockade runners. After the fort's occupation by Union troops, the crucial supply line was broken. The city of Wilmington fell in March 1865. Robert E. Lee, general of the Army of Northern Virginia, surrendered his troops in April. The war was over. Blockade running was arguably the lifeline of the Confederate war effort. Without it, the South could not continue to fight. As for the Condor, shortly after it ran aground, Confederate runners at Fort Fisher, who usually shot at Union ships, used it for target practice. The ship's remains lie in about 15 feet of water off the fort and New Inlet at Curie Beach. More than a dozen other wrecks of blockade runners dot the North Carolina coast, along with wrecks of other Civil War era ships. Learning about them helps us remember what happened to the Tar Heel State during the Civil War. Here are the captions of the two photographs that accompany this article. John Newland Maffitt became a well-known commander of both blockade runners as well as Confederate gunboats. And spy Rose O'Neill Greenhow, born 1817 and died 1864, and her daughter. Next, from the activities section, food for thought. The Civil War caused food shortages throughout North Carolina and many other states. With many farmers fighting in the war, fewer people were producing food. Those who did raise crops had to give a portion to Confederate agents for use in the war, further reducing supplies for those on the home front. The demand for this lower supply raised prices quickly and dramatically. Protests and bread riots over the lack of food and high prices occurred in some cities. There's a chart with this article, which is called Raleigh Food Prices, 1862 to 1865. It's from William Boyd's North Carolina booklet from 1915 called Fiscal and Economic Conditions in North Carolina During the War. It lists prices for each of the years, those 4 years, and what the prices were per item. For example, 1 pound of bacon in 1862 cost 33 cents. In 1863, $1. 1864, $5.50. 1865, $7.50. A pound of beef, 12 cents, then 50 cents. A year later, $2.50. In 1865, $3. In a pound of pork, there was no 1862 price, but in 1863, a pound of pork was $1.60. The next year, $4, and the following year, $5.50. A pound of sugar, 75 cents, went to $1. The following year, $12. The year after that, $30. A bushel of corn began at $1.10 in 1862, and then $5.50, $20, and then $30. A bushel of meal started at $1.25, went to $5.50, $20, and $30. A bushel of potatoes, $1, $4, $7, and finally $30 in 1865. A bushel of yams, $1.50, $5, $6, $35. A bushel of wheat, $3, $8, $25, and finally $50. And a barrel of flour started at $18, then $35, the next year $125, and in 1865, $500 for a barrel of flour. Here's another activity. Try a little hardtack. Hardtack is a hard biscuit made of flour, salt, and water, often given to Civil War soldiers as part of their daily rations. Try making and tasting your own hardtack. Here are the ingredients. 2 parts of flour and 1 part of water with a pinch or two of salt. The directions are to preheat the oven to 375 degrees. Put flour and salt into a bowl and stir them together. Add water a bit at a time, still stirring. When the mixture gets too thick to stir with the spoon, continue with your hands. If the dough is sticky, add a little more flour. If powdery, add a little more water. Shape the dough into a ball. Flatten it on a floured surface with the palm of your hand. Roll out dough until about a half inch thick. Cut in squares or circles. Use a skewer or a nail to poke even holes in each piece. Place on the baking sheet. Bake until browned on both sides, about 10 minutes per side. Taste your hardtack. That was adapted from American Kids in History, Civil War Days. Here's another sidebar. Remembering the Civil War, North Carolina at secession. The 1860 population of North Carolina was 992,622. Of that total, 629,942 were free whites. 331,059 enslaved African Americans, 30,463 free colored persons, and 1,158 American Indians. Of the total 992,622, 968,068 were rural residents. The largest town was Wilmington with 9,542 people. 34,658 families owned slaves. 4,065 of these owned 20 slaves or more and could be called planters. Most Tar Heels were yeoman farmers, working farms of up to a few hundred acres to grow or produce most of what they needed. The biggest industry was turpentine production. 2/3 of the nation's turpentine came from North Carolina. There were 48 textile mills operating. 23% of whites were illiterate. It was illegal to teach blacks to read, so no official literacy figures exist. And another Remembering the Civil War sidebar here and there. Here are some places to explore Civil War history in North Carolina. The Averasboro Battlefield, the Josiah Bell House in Beaufort, Fort Anderson, the Alexander Dixon House in Hillsboro, the Museum of the Albemarle, Fayetteville Arsenal, which is part of the Museum of the Cape Fear, Mendenhall Plantation in Jamestown, Fort Branch in Hamilton, the Greensboro Historical Museum, the Vance Birthplace in Weaverville, Smith McDowell House in Asheville, Museum of the Cherokee Indian, the Dismal Swamp Canal Visitors Center, and the Monument to United States Colored Troops in Hertford. You can learn more about North Carolina Civil War sites at the website of the Division of Historic Sites and Properties, www.nchistoricsites.org. Also, the website of the North Carolina Civil War Tourism Council, www.nccivilwar.com, and the Civil War Trails website, civilwartrails.org. Also, the National Park Service is offering special Civil War programs for students. We've run out of time for today's episode of North Carolina History. Be sure to listen next time. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Ed Tremblay, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.